Good afternoon, everyone. And in respect of Representative Atkins being here on time, even over his lunch hour, we're going to start as close on time as we can. So thank you all for being here. We do not have a quorum, so I will not call the meeting to order yet, but we appreciate Commissioner Doman and the department being here. And Commissioner, thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you. We are pleased to be here today. And we appreciate you taking the time to have our conversation with us about our fiscal year 2016-2017 biennial budget. As part of this budget presentation, we'll also be giving somewhat of an overview of the Department of Public Safety as well. So the public safety mission is to create a safer Minnesota, and all that we do at the Department of Public Safety is geared around making sure that the people in this state feel safe. And so our mission is to protect citizens and communities. In all of our different divisions, our efforts surround prevention, preparation, response, recovery, education, and enforcement. And our focus is on saving lives and providing efficient and effective services to the people of Minnesota, all while we maintain the public trust and develop strong partnerships with our public safety professional partners around the state of Minnesota. Our agency is unique in that the Department of Public Safety is split into funding from the funding and policy decisions from the transportation, public and policy, or policy and finance committees, and then also from the public safety policy and finance committees. Falling under the Transportation Committee is the Minnesota State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Pipeline Safety, and Administration and Related Services, which include our Fiscal Department and our Human Resources Department and Internal Affairs. And then under the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committees are the divisions of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, the State Fire Marshal's Division, the Office of Justice Programs, Emergency Communication Networks, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Our total Department of Public Safety budget base for fiscal year 16-17 out of the Transportation and Public Safety Divisions is as follows. Out of the Trunk Highway Funds, $191,107,000. Out of state government special revenue accounts is $127,622,000. The highway user tax distribution account of $20,836,000. Miscellaneous special revenue accounts, $118,669,000. And the general fund of $192,423,000 for a total of all funds of approximately $606.6 million. Our expenses for the fiscal year 16-17 biennium transportation and public safety divisions are as follows. Local assistance of $128,220,000. Out of transfers, $71,192,000. Payments to individuals, which is a small 1%, of $3,638,000. Operating costs of $142,374,000. And total compensation of $305,233,000. As our presentation goes on, you'll hear more detail about the Governor's Department of Public Safety budget recommendations, but I wanted to just highlight the initiatives, and then we'll have more detail coming up. Number one is a change item to increase the state trooper escort rate in the Minnesota State Patrol to add one fixed-wing aircraft. Additional appropriation for capital security for the Capital Area Complex. The establishment of an increased spending authority for the driver and vehicle services, increased spending authority for the driver and vehicle services division. The establishment of an international fuel tax agreement reinstatement fee. Creating a data services unit within the driver and vehicle services division. And then fine increases for a second and subsequent offense for texting while driving. And then increased operational support for the department of 1.8%. And I will now turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Mark Danansky.
Welcome, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mark Danansky, Department of Public Safety. And Mr. Chair, Commissioner and I are suffering with kind of a tough, both of us have colds, so if you kind of indulge us, I've got cough drops and kind of to get us through this. Mr. Chair, how would you like me to do this? Do you want me to stop after every division or just move all the way through?
Well, right now, go ahead and continue with your presentation. When we do have questions, we will try and stop it at a, as we do right now, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, if we were going on to him, I did have just a quick question about the two of the slides that she just went over, and that is, and this is the area where people often say this is where we have leakage from the Trunk Highway Fund. So of this, these columns, I don't see a number on that slide. I'm assuming just those under the transportation column come out of the highway fund and not the ones in the second column, right? None of those. And then
that's correct.
Of these recommendations, which of these do not come out of the trunk highway fund? Where it says governor's budget recommendations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we'll go into detail of each of those. We'll have a separate slide for each of the change items that will cover that information.
Okay, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick clarification question. You mentioned an international food tax agreement reinstatement fee, and I'm not familiar. I'm just wondering if you could give me a little background on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that too will come up as a separate slide to describe the change items.
Thank you.
Great. Deputy Commissioner, please continue.
Mr. Chair, starting off with administrative and related services for the Department of Public Safety. Under this area is our communications area, the Commissioner's Office, our Human Resources Department, our Fiscal and Administrative Services Department, our Office of Technology and Support Services, and our Internal Affairs Office. Under the administration, since it does cover the entire organization, one of the budget initiatives that we have is for operational support for the department, and the recommendation is for 1.8%. Agencies were instructed to include a 1.8% increase to total compensation each year in their base budgets. However, because the Minnesota State Patrol operates 24 hours, 7 days a week, the governor is recommending 3% increase for that division. This recommendation is intended to allow the agencies to maintain their current level of agency operations. I'm sorry. And then you'll see on the breakout of the funding on this, in fiscal year 16, $177,000 general fund, 17, $236,000 general fund, 16, $3.041 in trunk highway and special revenue funds, and in 17, $6.164 in trunk highway and special revenue funds. The mission of the Minnesota State Patrol is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to its allied agencies, and provide for safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's highways. The State Patrol is comprised of approximately 807 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. They have an annual operating budget of approximately $88 million. And as you can see over the biennium, funding comes from four primary areas: the Trunk Highway Fund, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, General Fund, and approximately $14 million in federal funds. I won't read through all this, but as you can see under the Minnesota State Patrol, in addition to their patrolling activities, they have a number of different areas, including vehicle crimes units, DWI enforcement, investigative services, radio communications, and special response. There are three budget proposals under the Minnesota State Patrol. The first is to increase the State Patrol trooper escort rate. This proposal recommends changing the statutory rate charged by the State Patrol to assist with the movement of oversized loads or traffic control needs to more closely reflect the actual operating cost of this service. The proposal also allows the Commission to set the average rate based upon the actual cost per fiscal year. Because the rate does not cover the actual cost incurred by the department, it's having an impact on the State Patrol's budget of approximately $145,000 per year. Just to kind of clarify that, the rate at which they can charge for the troopers is set in statute. And so as years go by, that rate is consistent and doesn't change as costs go up.
Excuse me, Deputy Commissioner, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to hear it again. You said that $14 million out of the $87 million, $88 million is from the federal government. And is that then out of the Highway User Trust Fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I could ask the Colonel to come down, but I believe that those are grants to the State Patrol for traffic safety initiatives. And in fact, most of those go to the commercial vehicle section.
And perhaps you could just elucidate that a bit, the commercial vehicle section grants, what?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Chair? I think I'll have Colonel Langer come down and explain it himself.
Good morning. For the record, Colonel Matt Langer from the State Patrol, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That $14 million is primarily made up of MCSAP funds from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. It's granted to us to carry out commercial vehicle enforcement duties across the state of Minnesota, both our agency and sub-granting to other agencies. And the rest of that federal funding would be enforcement work related to NHTSA, DWI enforcement, seatbelt enforcement, distracted driving, and the move-over law.
So, Mr. Chair, then, sir, are you saying that it is coming out of the Highway User Trust Fund?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it's not. Those are funds that come directly from the federal government.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the second proposal is having to do with the capital security. In order to better provide security based on the needs and risk assessments, the governor proposes to eliminate the current capital complex agency security contracts and provide a direct appropriation to the Department of Public Safety. Under this proposal, security coverage for the capital complex or the agencies in the capital complex would be enhanced. This is, in fact, a recommendation from the Advisory Committee on the Capital Area Security, and it is $1.57 million per year general fund. The third item for the State Patrol is fixed-wing aircraft. The Minnesota State Patrol operates three fixed-wing aircraft and three helicopters to provide traffic and public safety services. The three fixed-wing aircraft that the State Patrol operates now are approximately 33 years old. The State Patrol has been preparing for this proposal for several years by selling three fixed-wing aircraft and a helicopter to offset the costs. The remaining proceeds of those sales, approximately $373,000, combined with this proposal, will allow for the purchase of a new, efficient, safe aircraft with the technology needed to operate it. And that is $975,000 of trunk highway.
Thank you. A couple questions, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman and Mr. Danaski. Can I ask a question back earlier when you talked about the 1.8% increase in personnel costs, and you said because the Highway Patrol is 24/7 that it needs to be 3%? I mean, I think 1.8% is 1.8% across, whether it's or not. What's the rationale for that?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, it is in recognition of the 24/7 efforts of the State Patrol, and it's in there as part of the governor's recommended budget. I think one of the other realistic problems that we face is upwards of 85% of our budget is directly related to salary costs, and I think that differs from a lot of other agencies. So as cost of living increases have gone up over the past several years, 10 years or so, and increased retirement contributions have hit our agency, our costs have escalated and hit our line staff with reductions in personnel more so than perhaps other agencies.
Representative Petersburg.
Okay, I can understand if we got hit with reductions, we certainly need to work about getting those there. But the 1.8% was really, I thought, was talking about existing staff and the increases for them. So this going to 3% would be then also an additional staffing increase as well?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I don't know that I'd say additional. It would get us back to maybe historically where we once were and we aren't right now today.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just seemed like then why wouldn't we go 3% across the board for everybody? I think the funding sources and the levels at which we have, if it's designed really to increase at a certain percentage for a particular reason, then it should be sufficient for everything too. So just curiosity. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Danaski, I'm looking at the aircraft schedule here. knowing a few things about the airplanes. The way I'm looking at this, I understand that you've sold all three of your fixed wings, and so your other sale of one helicopter. So if I read this right, you're just down to two helicopters?
Mr. Janeski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry if that was not clear. The fleet has actually been reduced by four aircraft. At one time, the fleet existed, had 10 aircraft in it, so that we've sold three of the aircraft and one helicopter, so the fleet is now down to six, three fixed wing and three helicopters.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
My other question is the proceeds for this $900,000 for the acquisition of a new aircraft, is this a fixed wing or a helicopter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a fixed wing.
And Mr. Chair? What type of airplane is this new one that you're considering?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't determined a type of aircraft yet. This would go out, and we would have to do an RFP and do some research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the change item on the state trooper escort rate, it's my understanding, Mr. Dineski, that so you're going to increase the cost here. Are you looking at increasing just the direct cost, or are you considering all the indirect costs that go into this, such as overhead depreciation and things like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. We look to break even when we do these services, so we don't factor in depreciation. We factor in our salary costs. We factor in some of the administrative costs that come with the personnel, and we factor in the vehicle costs related to fuel and some maintenance items.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
you know, usually when you do this, you inevitably miss something. And when I used to do this kind of stuff, I'd always throw in a little bit of a profit factor to cover some of this. I mean, frankly, it's very, very important if you're doing this. You've been running a deficit, right? And it's very, very important that you capture all of your costs. And now, is it my understanding that in the past this has been set by statute, so you've been stuck with one cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're right on the money. There is no profit factor built in. It's an average cost that we've submitted, and it is actually set in statute today at $79.28 per hour with a vehicle.
And say again?
If it's per hour with a vehicle, because there are times where we provide service where it doesn't require a vehicle, and therefore the hourly rate is less. But you're exactly right. So that statute rate gets set, and then costs escalate, and until we can get back before the legislature where we are stuck billing and recovering costs at that rate set in statute.
Mr. Chair,
did
you say how much was it? $7 and
79.
70. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Commissioner, before we move on from State Patrol, certainly what's been talked about over the years is the funding, and that's being in transportation versus general fund. This comes up quite a bit. So just wondering, what would that, the difference there, what does that mean to the department in regards to where the funding comes from?
Larry?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Larry Freund with the Department of Public Safety. Currently, right now, our patrolling highway section there, they receive about $80 million in trunk highway funds. So it would be a different, that would be the amount of money that would have to go to the general fund instead of the trunk highway fund.
Mm-hmm. I guess that I understand that. Just wondering if the department has a comment just on the source of the funds, whether they come from the transportation budget or come from the general fund.
Mr. Chair, that this budget is from the governor. This is the governor's recommendation that we're at right now. Yeah.
So no comment. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Members, we do have a quorum, so the meeting is called to order. Representative Runbeck, have you had an opportunity to view the minutes of February 4th?
Mr. Chair, I'll approve the minutes. I'll move to approve the minutes of February 4th.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Moves the minutes of February 4th. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. These minutes are approved. Thank you for that. Let's please continue, Mr. Danasik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, we're on to the Office of Traffic Safety. The mission of what we're referred to as OTS is to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior in Minnesota through policy development and support, stakeholder engagement, program delivery, leadership, and research and evaluation. OTS receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000. That's a required match, which allows OTS to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to $17 million. And I think there was an error on your PowerPoint slide. I think it says something different on there, but the actual amount is $17 million. Some of the services that OTS provides is traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, seatbelt use, traffic records data systems, motorcycle safety, distracted driving, and traffic safety research and analysis. There's one proposal under the Office of Traffic Safety, and that is to increase the fine for texting while driving for a second and subsequent offense. We're looking to increase the current fine for second and subsequent offense from $50, which it is currently now, to $100. OTS has research that indicates and shows that increased fines can, in fact, be a deterrent to this type of violation. And it'll also help ensure that Minnesota remains competitive for federal grant dollars. Next, we have driver and vehicle services.
Mr. Chair. DVS's mission is...
Excuse me, Mr. Danasky. Apologize. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Danasky, moving fast here. So your $40 million is the total budget of Office of Traffic Safety, and these are all the programs, then, that are paid for out of that $40 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Danasky.
Representative, actually, it's not, it's as I said, I think it's my slide is correct. It's $17 million. I think there was an error on your slide. It's actually $17 million, Representative, and that is correct.
And, Mr. Chair, then, are you requesting more money at this time? I mean, the office is doing a great job because I think we aren't we second in the country in traffic deaths per thousand and really doing a fabulous job. I know, status quo is never enough, but it just seems like we're doing a great job. And, if we need more money, I guess why?
Thank you. We are, in fact, doing very well. Director Donna Berger and her staff have done an outstanding job. We are, in fact, the second safest state when it comes to fatalities per 100 million miles driven in the country, and we have been in that position for a couple of years now. We do not have an increase, a funding increase for this. The change item that you have before you to increase the fine money does not come to the Department of Public Safety. That is, goes to the regular judicial process where the fines are distributed. So there is no increase requested for OTS.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as I was saying, driver and vehicle services, they're committed to a fair, accurate, secure, and timely, or what they refer to as fast service. Through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for its staff and its business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $58 million. It has 538 employees working in 95 locations throughout the state. More than $1.4 billion of state revenue is collected annually by the Department of Vehicle Services. DVS is funded by special revenue funds and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Some of the services which many of you are familiar with at DVS, title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate, driver's exams, driver compliance, driver license issuing, public information center, operations support, and e-business. There are three proposals under the Department of Vehicle Services. The first is an increased spending authority from the Driver and Vehicle Services for the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. The proposal is seeking $600,000 ongoing from the accounts for staff salaries and benefits. Additionally, seeking $1.2 million from the vehicle services account to cover increased MinCorp costs for purchasing, delivering, and mailing plates, registration stickers, and notices. The next item is the International Fuel Tax Agreement Reinstatement Fee that we had the question about earlier. The IFT is an agreement between states and the Canadian provinces to simplify the reporting of fuel used by motor carriers that operate in more than one jurisdiction. other IFTA or IFTA jurisdictions collect a reinstatement fee from these carriers to pay for staffing costs associated with the administration of the IFTA regulations. And what we're looking to do is establish a reinstatement fee of $100 to cover the administrative costs when we have to reissue the permits to these truckers. And then the third item for the Department of Vehicle Services is creating a data services unit within DVS. This unit would conduct compliance audits, issue corrective action plans, and maintain and monitor user agreements. The budget proposes adding another staff person to assist current staff in providing legal advice and administration of the DVS data practices program. And the proposal requests $90,000 a year for that process. And then lastly, we have our Office of Pipeline Safety, which is housed within the State Fire Marshal's Division. The mission of the Office of Pipeline Safety is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident, and incident investigations, and education.
Mr. Janaski, could I have just pause one? We do have one question from the previous subject.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's appropriate, could you comment on the gross receipts tax from the governor's proposal and its effect on the IFTA?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think it has any impact on the IFTA. And as far as the gross receipts tax, I couldn't speak to that.
Representative Uglum. Are we waiting for a response? Oh, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. Representative, this the IFTA tax has to do with the taxes that are paid on the fuel that the state charges, and so what happens is there's a prorated version that goes to it, but the gross receipts tax is a separate tax. So I haven't seen this proposal as of yet, so I'll look at it, and if I see that there's some relationship, we'll get back to you.
Representative Kuznick?
Thank you.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question on a previous slide about the increased spending on the MnCOR cost of $1.2
million.
Okay. And perhaps, sorry to get you up and back. Could you explain to everybody what MnCOR is and how it operates and why $1.2 million is requested?
Ms. McCormick.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. MnCOR is an industry that produces the plates for the state, and it's run through the Department of Corrections. And DVS pays for the, or has a contract with MnCOR to produce the plates that we require and that we issue to citizens in Minnesota. And so there's a contract that we have with MnCOR where we need to pay for all the supplies that they use in order to produce the plates. And the plate costs have increased through the years, and I don't have it right in front of me, but in a minute I can find it. But the plate costs have increased through the last several years. And so because we only get a certain appropriation from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, we have had to pay for the rest of the production costs from our vehicle services account. And so as a result, in order to be able to produce the plates and to be able to have inventory at every one of our deputy registrar offices throughout the state, we have had to use vehicle services money, and so as a result, we have not hired the staff that we need for vehicle services because we need to ensure that we're meeting the requirements of the state in terms of plate production. And so what we're asking for is, because the statute only gives us a fixed appropriation for plate production, we're asking for additional money so that we can pay for the costs associated with the plate production from our vehicle services account.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Ugel.
Thank you. So am I to understand that in this case that MinCor is the sole supplier to the state of Minnesota, and that if they request X amount of million, or 2 million, or 3 million, or 4 million, that's what it's going to be?
McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are basing the costs on the number of orders that we have for plates for production, and in order to have just a certain level of inventory at all deputy registrar offices so that people can come in and purchase those plates when they are buying a vehicle or when they're coming in to buy a new plate because their plate is 7 years old and we need to get a new one. That's the arrangement that has been in place for many, many years.
So you, Chair, well, you didn't answer my question. Is MinCor the sole supplier of the license plates to the state?
I'm sorry. Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is the statutory provisions are that they are the supplier of the plates for the state.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
You.
And MinCor is a for-profit organization?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I really don't know how to classify it. As far as I know, it's not for profit. I think they have a certain amount of money that then they use in order to produce the plates. That's the mission of that industry. That's part of the Department of Corrections. So I would you'd have to ask that question of the Department of Corrections. I can get back to the committee on that. I'll talk to the Department of Corrections, and we can respond to your question.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair and Representative, just finishing up the last thing, which was our Office of Pipeline Safety, which I mentioned is actually housed within the State Fire Marshal's Division. The State Fire Marshal Division falls under the Public Safety Committee, but Pipeline Safety falls under the purview of this committee. As mentioned, it does operate on a budget of $3.133 million per year. That's from special revenue and federal funds.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Donaski, this isn't a question so much about the budget for the OPS, but you mentioned there's a $1.35 million per year as a direct appropriation special revenue derived from inspection fees. You know, how often do you do these inspections, and do citizens have access to, you know, the results of, you know, if there's violations or, you know, the current status of a particular pipeline and when it's been inspected and what the record of inspection is?
Please state your name for the committee.
Mr. Chair, yes. My name is John Wolfgram. I'm the Chief Engineer with the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety.
Thank you.
I can answer that question for Representative Hornstein.
Go ahead.
The way that the billing works, essentially, or it's an invoicing to the pipeline operators throughout the state of Minnesota. It's proportional to how many customers they have. We're talking about distribution systems that feed gas to our homes, or mileage for large interstate and intrastate operators. These companies are invoiced on a quarterly basis. The way the inspection planning works, we typically work with each operator in the state on the intrastate assets. Those would be pipelines that start and end in our state on a yearly basis. Might be different types of inspections that occur, but typically on a yearly basis, we're out with all of these pipeline companies. The way that the data practice or the data sharing, the public is open to requesting that information. Closed cases with those inspection results can be released to the public at any time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sedin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the enforcement the pipeline safety regulations, how many violations do you occurred during a typical year, and are there fines levied out?
Representative Sundin, could you please pull the mic down, please? Okay. Thank you.
In regard to the inspections and enforcement, could you fill us in, if you would, on how many violations occur in a typical year, and what types of fines are levied, if any?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Violations and enforcement we have various options of what that enforcement can look like. We can have anything of a warning pertaining to regulations. I should also add that Office of Pipeline Safety, we have jurisdiction over interstate pipelines here in the state of Minnesota as well as intrastate. The difference kind of comes in the enforcement. So if we're talking about interstate pipelines, the enforcement is carried out by the federal government, where they go through and they assess the order and the civil penalties. In the state of Minnesota, we have a penalty process on pipeline operators where we can do up to $100,000 per day per violation with a $1 million cap on that series of related violations. As far as, you know, what trending looks like, these vary from year to year. Typically, we're not getting into, you know, fines of $100,000. If you'd like, we could certainly provide you with some historical basis of what penalties and what violations look like for the state.
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate that history. Thank you.
Right. Mr. Danaski, was that the completion of?
Mr. Chair, we have completed.
And Commissioner, you said you would be making comments on the pipeline safety report, or would that be later?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, we'll be giving an overview of the report that was mandated by legislation last year that the Department of Public Safety completed.
Right. Okay. And we'll do that in a little bit. Thank you very much. We'll have an update on the MNLARS system. Good afternoon. Please state your name for the committee and proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dawn Olson. I'm the MNLARS Program Director for the Department of Public Safety.
And Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Meekin. I'm the CIO for Minute Services at the Department of Public Safety.
We're here today to provide you with an update on the MNLARS project. MNLARS, known as the Minnesota License and Registration System, is a multi-year system upgrade project of Driver and Vehicle Services, a division of the Department of Public Safety. MNLARS replaces DVS's nearly 40-year-old mainframe system and its 15-year-old e-support system, the more secure, reliable, flexible, modern system. MNLARS will be the updated information system for driver's licenses, and identification cards, driver compliance, vehicle title and registration, dealer licensing and inspection, inventory, and finance. In addition to providing valuable services to Minnesota residents, MNLARS also maintains vital partnerships with law enforcement, local, state, and federal agencies, courts, deputy registrars, and driver's license agents, all whom rely on DVS data to conduct their daily business. With today's demands for DVS data and access, the security of MNLARS is first and foremost. We are building a secure system from today's technology to ensure data access is appropriate and users are thoroughly reviewed and approved. Today, MNLARS has more than 1,200 deputy registrar and state staff users accessing the MNLARS system to conduct DVS business. The partnership between DPS and MNIT is a vital and respected working relationship. Both departments are committed to the success of MNLARS, share a common vision for MNLARS, and work collaboratively to reduce barriers and oversee the project plan, with an executive sponsor committee providing leadership and support for the program. The next phase on the MNLARS roadmap is to design the motor vehicle portion, which includes vehicle titles, vehicle registration, financial tracking, and inventory. At this time, we will take your questions if you have any regarding MNLARS.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Is there an effort going on to move to an electronic data storage? I know I've got a local deputy registrar. When I was talking to them, they have, I don't even know how large of a mini storage filled with the actual paper records that they have to hold on to for a period of time. What's the timeline on switching to electronic data storage?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we are definitely looking to modernize our document management system just because of the volume and the capacity that paper can entail for storage. So our next phase as we move into motor vehicle document management will be a part of that process as well, which is a huge barrier for the deputy registrars and both driver's license agents.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that. I'll share with you what I shared with. My biggest concern wasn't so much, and they didn't tell me how much it was costing me each month for the mini storage, but nor would they tell me where the mini storage was. But I'm picturing all of these records, and I think they've got, what you'd know better than I do, name, address, mm-hmm. phone numbers and addresses, and do they have Social Security numbers?
Representative, and some documents they could if it's driver's license applications.
And so, Mr. Chairman,
Atkins.
We've been led to believe at my little office in South St. Paul that our electronic data storage is actually more secure than our off-site paper storage, which is also in a mini storage place just down the road. Is that your sense as well? I literally, that's not a loaded question. I don't know, but that's what our electronic folks tell us, is it's military level and all of this and that. So is it more secure to have it stored electronically or more secure to have it in paper fashion, if you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be our goal as well, is to have it in the most secure environment possible, and that is our understanding, that an electronic environment would provide that for us. A couple of things, ease of access to that information is more readily available. Systems are backed up on a document management versus just having paper stored somewhere. There's a lot of potential that could be lost or destroyed or whatever the case may be. So that is first and foremost, that those documents are stored in electronic fashion, easy to retain and retrieve, but also highly secure.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have just one other.
Absolutely, Representative Atkins.
Aside from the electronic storage issue, the House GOP, I know, has their budget for, I think it falls into this as well, Mr. Chairman, that it's $200 million if I read it correctly. Do you know what the impact on MNLAR is? And I'd have the same question for public safety or for the State Patrol. What the impact of that is at all on your agency or department?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure that would be in the same realm as the MNLARS project, because I'm not familiar with what you're describing here. Not that I would know of, anyway.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, is that, and I confess I don't know if that's, is the $200 million budget that the GOP proposed been shared? Is it a bill?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Representative Atkins, no, that was, it wasn't spelled out disbursement-wise.
Do you happen to know if there's an impact on MNLARS or on the State Patrol as part of that?
No.
Okay. Is there a date, Mr. Chairman, when we will have, I see we're going through the governor's proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a date when we've got the House GOP proposal to compare against?
Representative Atkins and members, no. At this point in time, I can tell you we are working on that, and we're going to get into actually hearing bills probably next week, and it will be sometime after that.
Okay. You have a best guess, perhaps? This is actually really helpful to me, is now getting down to what we're actually paying for or not paying for.
Absolutely.
And obviously the House GOP is in control of this body. And I'm not trying to be a dink about it, by the way. I just want to, it would really help to have one and do sort of a side-by-side and figure out what we're getting and what we're not. Yet in each of the two budgets. Yeah, but is it 5 days out? Is it 10 days out?
Representative Atkins, I would say we're still in the process, just like the governor is. We haven't seen the governor's bill language either, so we're all kind of working off that, the same calendar and February forecast and all of that as well.
Okay, then one final question. If his isn't in bill form yet either, do you have a document like this that we can work off of that at least has just sort of the general amounts, even if it's not in bill fashion yet?
Not yet, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Olson, one of the things that, I've got to speak with Commissioner Dolan about this as well. Mintler's history a little bit. If you could go through some of that, because it certainly has had some challenges, you know, so for the committee to understand what we've gone through in the last several years to the point where we are now.
Mr. Chair, the Mintler's project has gone through some peaks and valleys, so to speak. We started collecting the technology fee in 2008, and at that time gave us time to plan for and prepare for what the Mintler's project would entail and what that would look like. We decided that we were going to procure an outside vendor to be able to build the system for us. So we went through a lengthy procurement process that concluded in 2011. We then went into a contract and negotiated a contract in 2012 with a vendor to take on and build the entire system for us at that time. So we worked the last 2 to 3 years with an outside vendor and started to rethink whether an outside vendor was really the best for the going forward with the project. In 2013, we started noticing that we were having some challenges with an outside vendor, and we started to provide more strict guidance and insistence with the vendor on what the requirements needed to be and to meet our demands for our implementing this system. We negotiated, and we found that at this point, it was in our best interest that we end the agreement and we take on the project ourselves, that we felt we had enough capacity within the Department of Public Safety and Minute that it would be in our best interest that we would guide this project. And so officially at the end of 2014, we ended our agreement, and we have been working on moving ahead with the project as an internal process. We're highly confident in the staffing that we have. Instead of a large procurement, we're going to instead procure smaller entities and organizations and skill set that we're going to need to be able to bring them in on a shorter term basis and provide the skills that we need to be able to build this system. We're in the process of bringing in those vendors right now, and as I said, we are updating our priorities based on some of the statutory requirements that have been laid before us, and so being able to switch our priorities made it amendable for us to be able to make some changes and put the project in a different direction, and we feel comfortable with that.
Ms. Olson, what are the dollar amounts that you have collected, and how much have you spent then?
To date, we've collected in the technology fee roughly about $70 million. Our project, the Mintler's project, has been budgeted for $93 million. We have spent approximately $34 million, and so we are basing our budget going forward on the remaining dollars that we have and we will collect up until the technology sunsets in June of 2016.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, following along that line here, The original revenue to build this system was a surcharge on licenses or license fees. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, it was. The technology fee was $1.75, and that was assessed on motor vehicle transactions and driver's license transactions.
So, Ms. Olson, that the taxpayers are paying, and we've spent, according to the spreadsheet I have here, $36 million, and we don't have a working system yet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have put into place our priorities and the first phase of Mintler's as what was under the contract and agreement with the primary vendor that we had. We've made a lot of enhancements to the Mintler's project as far as in preparation for this system. But in response to your question as far as, you know, where we're at in the process, our next big push is to get the motor vehicle functionality delivered, because that is a priority not only for DVS but for this legislative body as well. And so we feel very comfortable that we will be able to deliver that functionality by October of 2016.
Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Olson, we don't have a functioning system at this time. We've spent $36 million. My question to you is, the outside vendor that we discharged, who was that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the vendor that we had under contract was Hewlett-Packard.
Okay. Representative, thank you. And Ms. Olson, now we are taking this in-house at this point in time, halfway through the project. What gives you the comfort zone, if you will, that if Hewlett-Packard can't deliver, one of the largest technology companies in the world, that we can get this project back on track?
Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Meek? Yeah.
Representative? When we look at this project, what we really look at is how MNIT as a whole is organizing and handling this project. And so our focus, really being the government IT agency, is that we have expertise in how to do IT for government. We have found, working with HP, that we were able to be more agile in how we adjust the project for the priorities as they come up in it. And we have full access to a fantastic information technology community here in the metro area and beyond to bring those resources in. So what we're really talking about here is how this project is organized and run, and we really feel strongly that MNIT Services, in partnership with Public Safety and DVS, has the right people that understand the priorities and understand how to build projects for government, and that's how we're proceeding.
Mr. Chair, one final.
Tim Huba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson or Mr. Meekin, what guarantees does this body have that there aren't going to be cost overruns as we're halfway through this and we've spent $36 million. Do we have any guarantees that there aren't going to be continual costs and continual surcharges on our taxpayers for the coming years?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are fully intended to finish development on MNLARS with the money that we've been allocated. We have no intention of coming and asking for any further funding for development. So we have prepared a budget for what that's going to entail, and we are both DPS and MNIT are overseers of this budget and managing where the funding will be going to make sure that we don't overrun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just kind of follow up questions a little bit on that line. Now, you said we've collected about $70 million, but we've got some additional funding that has been appropriated from here as well, correct?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've also have additional funding that comes from the motor vehicle transaction side of the business. That's dedicated funding that was appropriated for the use towards MNLARS as well.
Thank you. And just kind of the final question is that I know Ms. McCormick was in front of this committee quite a few times over the last 2 years, you know, talking about MNLARS and the deadlines and when it would be coming up to speed, because we had some legislation in regards to individual counties wanting different levels of assessments and so forth for their vehicles. Where are we on those timelines? Are we still in those timeline ranges, or are we now postpone that for another few years?
So,
Mr. Chair and Representative, that was a key priority for the department as we were reassessing our priorities, because we knew that there was statutory language around providing that flexibility on the wheelage tax. So that has been shifted, and that's our first priority, and that's what I was referring to. Our intention is to have that functionality in place by 2016 in preparation for the calendar year beginning 2017, which is within the statutory guidelines.
So my understanding from you is that it will be ready in 2016, at the end of that year, beginning of the year, somewhere for beginning of the 2017 calendar fiscal year. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Okay, thank you. And then just the last final follow-up. Then the rest of the system, when will that be up and ready?
Mr. Chair and Representative, our plan then is to move it to prepare for the driver services part as we're doing development on the motor vehicle, and that driver services will have the following year, start of 2017, development will start on the driver services portion.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for either testifier. I'm looking at the report here. It's the MNLARS project audit findings report. And in the recommendations, of which there are nine for top recommendations, number one says improve business processes before automating them. I'm wondering if you could, Mr. Chair, please expand on what efforts have been put into improving the processes before automating them.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's been a lot of effort that has taken place because of the nature of the DVS business. There's a lot of processes that are currently very manual in nature, and that's because of the limitations that we have around the current information system that we're using. So we are taking this time now to really look at those processes and making sure that the system will automate and provide the efficiencies that we need. We took that recommendation from the audit very seriously, and we had made some initial work on that, and we had made some headway on it. But with this opportunity for taking the design of the system in-house, that's made it even more of a priority and a viable option. And so that is a key priority for the department. They're working on that continuously, and that'll be incorporated into the new system as we go forward.
Follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to hear that because I think that it is very important, being one, as I mentioned in a previous committee meeting with a technology background, that is always our goal, is to look at existing processes, not to just jump to automating them, but to ensure that they are the most efficient before automating them. Because we do have an example in the state here with another technology system. Looking at this report here from under the paragraph historical perspective, it is a system that perpetuates outdated, inefficient, paper-driven processes and is difficult to modify without major programming efforts. So again, I'm happy to hear that. But the other example of a technology system that is brand new, MNsure, right? Brand new technology system supposed to have top quality processes, but then incorporated paper, you know, as it says here, paper-driven processes. I'm just hoping that we can work on that. Mr. Chair, the next question I would have, I believe this is the handout that the testifiers passed out. The first bullet point says, under identity access management, MNLARS has more security around individual users and how users are accessing DVS data. The last several years we've seen, Mr. Chair, examples in the news of reports where users were accessing DVS records that didn't necessarily have a business justification to do so. So on this bullet point, MNLARS has more security. Could you expand upon accountability? Security is important, but accountability in some cases is even more important.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, absolutely. That is certainly a number one priority for us. The challenge we face right now with the current system is we don't have a way to be more proactive in our auditing procedures to ensure that people are going where they're supposed to be going. We're more reactive. So that is one of the criteria as we talk about the MNLARS security. When we talk about enhancing, we have a more thorough review of the users that are being provided access to that data. We have more specific qualifications around what those roles are and what kind of data they're going to be able to see when they're there. So that's part of our plan to get to that accountability, is that we'll be able to know exactly where a user went, what information they had access to, but in addition to that, they're not going to be able to, just because of the limitations on the system, have access to way more than what they actually need to be able to do their jobs. So there's kind of two parts to that process. Was we need them to have the information that they're going to need, but in the same token, not be able to have too much information that could create problems down the road.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Olson. The department with legislative authority to do so embarked on developing this program, how much was the original estimated cost at that time?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, are you talking about the original MNLARS cost? I'm not quite sure of your question.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Ms. Olson. How much was with the development of MNLARS when it was authorized in 2008, was it? what was the projected cost of development of the project at that time?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe the estimated cost was around $48 million.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Olson, how much do you expect it'll cost between now and realizing we've spent I don't know how many years and I still haven't figured out how many tens of millions of dollars of the people's money to do this, but now that we've switched gears and taken a different approach, how much will it cost in your estimate for your agency in minute to complete the project between now and 2016?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, our estimated budget is around $56 million.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Olson. Ms. Olson, so you've spent, according to the spreadsheet that I think is on the, there's a MNLARS website, Minute and MnDOT are together in their logo here on the handout I have anyway. We spent $37 million so far, and now we are changing gears and going to plan to spend another $56 million on top of that. Is that correct?
Mr. Oh. Chair and Representative, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Runbeck.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to the deputy registrars and those independent registrars that we have out there. What cost is it to them to upgrade to this system? And kind of explain the system. Is this a web-based system, or are they going to have to tie in through the? How is this system supposed to work for those deputy registers, those independent outfits? And is this going to make that an easier process? Are they going to have to upgrade their systems? How is this going to work, and what cost it is to those deputy registers out there?
Ms. Wilson,
sure.
Mr. Meekin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So the technical requirements that you so often see is the minimum requirements for a system. In this case, are very standard as far as, you know, if you have a PC that you refresh every 4 or 5 years, right, that generally that puts you at the minimum requirement level. So we did roll out version one of the system last year, and as a part of that, all the deputy registrars did upgrade their technology for their desktops to use the system. And so we've gone through that part with them. The piece that's remaining, you know, as we plan out the rest of it, notably document management and things like that, there may be some additional equipment or devices that are needed, and we haven't made any final decisions on that yet. But the core piece of technology, which is really simply a computer, a desktop or a laptop, that is, I feel very comfortable in saying that's fairly standard type configuration for a modern desktop or laptop. It's about keeping your devices relatively current, and that should make it compatible with the system.
Representative Powell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it going to be a web-based system then, or?
You know, we will have Mr. both. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative, yes. We will have both types of user interfaces. We will have a web interface for many, and in some cases we'll have a very typical like application that you would put on your PC, depending on the type of user.
So,
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we go more automated, are we going to be, for some of these, are we going to be bypassing a lot of that to be going to directly to the state system in order to do some of these? And my concern is some of the activity a lot of these are small outfits out there, and they rely on the income they get on the transactions. My concern is much like if I mail my tab fee in, we bypass the county, and the county does not, my home county does not get the dollar. My concern is the capability of bypassing that county register, that deputy register, those dollars are going to cease to go there, and we'll have fewer and fewer of these that can provide that interaction with our and answer the tough questions out there, that personal interaction. And my concern is we're going to cut them out of the loop because of the fees that don't go there. So I have a concern as we go down this road that we're going to have fewer and fewer deputy registrars that's able to financially stay in business. So I I guess if you could address that concern of mine.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've had these similar conversations with the deputy registrars as well. It is certainly not the expectation that MNLARS is going to bypass. Our job is to look at customer service options for the citizens, those that live in the state, those that live out of the state. What are the best options that we can provide, regardless of what your preference is? And so we have worked very closely with the deputy registrars to talk about these concerns. We're engaging them in conversations to think about the future and come up with some strategic plans for what this business will look like in the future. We've also asked them to participate in our ongoing development of MNLARS because they are the face of DVS in a lot of communities, and we want to make sure that they're seeing and understanding what the MNLARS system will look like. It's a challenge when the system becomes more automated that people will assume that our job is to cut people out or minimize their roles. That is certainly not our intention whatsoever. Our job is to make service options available for the citizens, at the same time making sure that we're compliant with the way we collect our funding. We have a system that's going to offer those checks and balances for us and hopefully make life a little bit easier for everybody involved. The deputies have said our main focus is that we have something user-friendly and that offer the efficiencies that we need, and we take those things very seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any thought to maybe allowing those surcharges to go back to the county where it originated to?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can't speak to that. That's kind of beyond the MNLARS regime.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just sort of following up on that, but from a totally different perspective, and this, I'm sure, is a controversial question, but on the other hand, is our current system an inefficient system? In other words, we've always had all of these deputy registrar offices. That's the current system. Because we have new ways of relating now to the public, has that simply become an expensive, inefficient system? And are we hanging on to a past structure just because they've always been there?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, that's an ongoing discussion. We're doing everything we can to keep the current system viable, and we know that change, no matter what the change is going to be on the new system, is going to be it's going to take some evolvement, so to speak. And so, you know, we're always weighing the conflict between the way we do business now and the way we need to do business in the future. And the charge that Paul and I have is to be thinking about the future. What is going to be the expectations around technological needs, and how can we make this system flexible enough that we can advance the system going forward and not have the same kind of challenges that we're faced with today, which is very limiting on how we can provide services. Things that we're thinking about today, we probably weren't thinking about 5-6 years ago when the MNLARS project was first talked about. And so we are always weighing those options because of the needs of our citizens, what they need, what works for them in their daily life. And also in the same token, having that presence for those that still want that face-to-face service. So whether it's an expense, we certainly look at the expense of that, but our main purpose is looking at that flexibility that we need in the system, that we can offer those options going forward. And that is our primary goal for this.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, nothing like a MNLARS discussion to get everyone going on a Monday here. But this is more of a request or an ask than a question. And you know, I appreciated last summer when the department met with Senator Dibble and I, and you gave us a briefing on the situation with Hewlett-Packard. Inevitably, it seems that there will be issues. You know, you're hearing bipartisan concerns about the trajectory of this project, both its history and its future. And I guess all I would ask is that you be proactive in your communication with the House and Senate transportation committees, the leadership and the leads. Because, you know, the concern I had about our meeting over the summer is it was relatively late in the game. And I think it'd be really helpful for there to be some, you know, more timely communication, because as you can see, this is an issue that really, again, bipartisanly, people have a lot of concerns and ownership over, obviously this affects our constituents in a profound way. So I would just make that request because, again, this is a priority for many of us.
Ms. Olson, did you have a comment?
Representative, or Mr. Chair and Representative, absolutely.
Okay. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, have we received any deliverables at all from HP, or are we just going to discard what was done and start over?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we did. HP was able to deliver release one for us, which included some of the things that I talked about in the handout, which was 8 electronic motor vehicle permits. Past permits were all paper process, and so this has made it system generated, easier to access, and available for those outside of the issuing office to be able to retrieve that information. We've instituted the identity access management system, which is a more secure system of allowing users to have access to the DBS data. And we've upgraded our international registration plan and international tax fuel agreement requirements for commercial vehicle registration. In addition, we work with HP to be able to transition all of the functionality from release one into the state environment, which kept us from having to possibly roll back what we sent out in release one. We now have full support and oversight over release one in the MNLARS system. We took back all of the equipment, the hardware, and the software that was purchased under the existing contract agreement. And we also secured any enhanced development that was done prior to ending our agreement with HP, which included business requirements, certain amount of code, system code that had been developed.
Mr. Drzkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Could you characterize for us then what percent of the project was delivered to us from HP then? Also wondering if we have a budget for the development going into the future, a complete budget from your two agencies, and could the committee get that before the end of the week? And then as part of that, I'm curious how many FTEs will be added to DPS and or Minute in order to accomplish this additional $56 million expenditure of the people's money.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's not easy to categorize what percentage has been completed with HP. It was part of release one, but it was a smaller release. So I would prefer to come back to you with a better answer around that question. As far as a copy of the complete budget, yes, we can provide that by the end of the week. We have detailed out a budget for what we plan to use the remaining funding of the MNLARS funding for. And as far as your question around how many FTEs we can plan to bring in, our plan is really to bring in outside consultants and temporary state employees, and then evaluate as we go forward the ongoing maintenance of this system and what those costs are going to be. So the budget that we can produce for you is going to be consultant time and temporary state employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Ms. Olson, along those lines, do you have an estimate of number of employees that it would take to for just maintenance once this is up and running? Do you have an estimate there?
Mr. Chair, that is a requirement that we have promised this committee that we would come back to you with as to what the ongoing maintenance would be. We have some statutory language around that to require that we come back and give you a more detailed description of what the maintenance is going to be and what that is going to take to staff that. So our plan is to come back to you next year with a more detailed plan.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Ms. Olson. Mr. Meekin, I appreciate your time with the committee. Now we will move on with the oil transportation preparedness study. Deputy Commissioner Janaski.
Mr. Chair, as we get set up, this is a overview of a report. The report is approximately 200 pages. I will try to summarize and hit the high points of it in about 10 or 15 minutes because I'm conscious of the time.
Just so the members know, this is a 180-page report that can be found. We put that in your minute notes. We did copy a portion of it, and the department is going to give us an overview of that, but if you do want some in-depth detail, that can be found on the website there. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, in 2014, as part of a comprehensive bill on railroad and pipeline safety, the Minnesota Legislature directed the Department of Public Safety to prepare a report on incident preparedness in both the public and private sectors related to the transportation of oil by rail and pipeline. DPS's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which I'll probably refer to as HSEM, contracted with the Management and Analysis Division of the Department Administration, commonly referred to as MAD, to draft the report and help develop recommendations for DPS's consideration. The legislation specifies several things. At a minimum, to summarize the preparedness and emergency response framework in the state, to provide an assessment of costs and needs of fire departments and other emergency first responders for training and equipment to respond to discharge or spill incidents involving transportation of oil, to develop a comprehensive public and private response capacity inventory that, to the extent feasible, includes statewide identification of major emergency response equipment, equipment staging locations, mutual aid agreements, and capacities across industries involved in the transportation of and storage of oil. Also, to provide information and analysis that forms the basis of the allocation of funds that were supplied under Minnesota Statute 299A.55. To develop benchmarks or assessment criteria for the evaluation of response preparedness and funding that has to be completed by January of 2017. To assist in long-range oil transportation incident preparedness and planning. And finally, to make recommendations for any legislative changes. Given the legislative direction, the study focuses on public safety preparedness and response to an oil transportation incident involving railroads or pipelines in Minnesota. The study does not provide analysis or recommendations on prevention activities, environmental mitigation, and cleanup infrastructure development, such as transportation or health system infrastructure, or relative merits of the different modes of oil transportation. MAD developed a research plan with the Department of Public Safety and conducted research for this study from August 2014 through December of 2014. MAD used several data sources to provide responses to the legislative requirements. MAD conducted a review and analysis of information on state and federal laws, state and federal agencies, approaches developed by other states and provinces, research, analysis, and guidance from experts in the field of emergency preparedness and response. MAD also conducted a focused literature review using research databases, government reports, public websites, and information from interviewees. They did comprehensive interviews with subject matter experts, including rail and pipeline company representatives, state agency representatives, and associations of first responders and local governments. A survey of fire department chiefs, sheriffs, police department chiefs, and emergency managers in jurisdictions that are potentially affected by an oil transportation incident were conducted. They also conducted focused interviews with state and local elected officials in areas potentially affected by an oil transportation incident. Some of the key findings of the report: oil and hazardous material incidents are one of many risks in Minnesota. Other threats, risks, and hazards are also of serious concern to emergency management officials. Oil is transported across Minnesota via rail and pipeline routes that cross large parts of the state. Almost any area of the state could be directly or indirectly affected by an oil transportation incident. In recent years, there have been relatively few hazardous materials or oil transportation incidents in Minnesota. Oil transportation has become a salient issue in Minnesota and elsewhere for several reasons. Increased production and distribution of oil from North Dakota and Alberta, catastrophic incidents involving rail and pipeline transport of oil, particularly recent derailments and fires involving shale oil from the Bakken fields, and findings from federal regulators that Bakken crude oil is highly volatile. Community stakeholders, including emergency management officials, elected officials, and the public, have expressed their concerns about rail transportation at community forums in recent months. Public safety aspects of oil transportation incidents are among their concerns. That being said, focused interviews with elected officials as part of this study indicated that constituents as a whole may not view preparedness for a possible oil transportation incident as a significant issue, given other priorities in their communities. Minnesota takes an all-hazards approach to emergency preparedness. State and local planners consider potential threats, risks, and hazards and plan accordingly. Under state and federal law, Minnesota has a comprehensive framework that would also apply to an oil transportation incident. Railroad and pipeline companies are ultimately responsible for responding to an emergency involving the substances they transport. But local first responders and state agencies also play a role. Minnesota's structured framework places an emphasis on coordination and collaboration across governments and sectors. New statutory provisions in Chapter 115E, established in 2014, outline specific responsibilities for rail companies that transport crude oil, including established response times and their requirements. Capacity to respond to protect public safety in an oil transportation incident involves a combination of components, including equipment, trained personnel, emergency plans, mutual aid agreements, and exercises to test the preparedness. Rail and pipeline companies maintain that they are ready and able to respond to an oil transportation incident, noting that they have their own firefighting and spill response resources in Minnesota and other states and have contractual relationships with other responders. Though companies identified specialty firefighting resources in their equipment and contractors list, much of the resources described by companies are focused on the environmental response to an oil incident. Homeland Security Emergency Management coordinates hazardous materials regional response teams that can provide assistance in an oil transportation emergency. The state has 10 chemical assessment teams in Minnesota, commonly referred to as CATS. Those teams have trained personnel and specialized equipment to assist local incident commanders in recognizing and identifying a hazard so local responders can respond appropriately. The state also has two emergency response teams, referred to as ERTs, that can take additional mitigation action to protect communities from the effects of an oil or other spill. State agencies, including the Department of Public Safety, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Minnesota Department of Transportation, provide expert advice to local governments if there's a hazardous material or oil transportation incident. If environmental cleanup is needed because of the spill, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency would ensure that the responsible party takes the necessary actions. The local government mutual aid infrastructure in Minnesota is well-developed, and most counties and cities have all-hazard emergency plans that would apply to an oil transportation incident. First responders surveyed for this study, however, are relatively unfamiliar with the private sector resources and regional response team resources available. Expert consulted for the study indicated that local governments generally do not have the equipment or personnel to respond to a significant oil transportation incident, such as a large spill or fire. Some emphasized, however, that local governments are not the primary responsible party for an oil transportation incident. The rail or pipeline company is, in fact, responsible. First responders reported access to some types of firefighting and spill response equipment locally or through mutual aid agreements. Information resources, such as information on train and pipeline contents and expert advice on appropriate response actions, were available to most responders surveyed, but not to all. About half of the first responders surveyed reported that their departments have staff members who have received training on how to respond to an oil transportation incident, where only about a third of it had indicated that they had participated in the training exercise since July of 2013.
Just a second. One moment, please. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to one of these key findings about the local government generally do not have the equipment or personnel to respond to a significant oil spill. You know, I represent the city of Coon Rapids, which has some tremendous exposure to an oil spill. We have many, many homes, single-family residences that are very close proximity. Given that we do not have that, could you expand a little bit on what the scenario would be? What could our local guys do if we had a major oil spill in, say, for instance, Coon Rapids or even, for that matter, Minneapolis?
Mr. Dunaski.
Mr. Chair, I have with me Kevin Reed from the Department of Homeland Security Emergency Management, who actually heads up our training and works with the fire departments on this exact type of question.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kevin Reed, Operations Branch Director, Minnesota Homeland Security Emergency Management Representative. It varies a little bit, obviously, from a full-time fire department to a volunteer fire department across the state, but the recommendations are to protect life first, property second. So depending if we're having a spill or a fire, it really is going to dictate what they're going to be able to do. So they're going to be able to take some emergency response actions, such as decide what they have, figure out what their best course response is, whether they can or cannot be able to fight that fire with the current resources, how they're going to bring their mutual aid in, and then go through their normal incident command stuff.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Follow-up. The reality of it is, if we had a major pipeline fire in our city of Coon Rapids, we're going to only be able to evacuate people out of there and watch the thing burn. Isn't that the real fact of the matter?
Mr. Reed.
Chairman, Representative, in some of those cases, yes, the option is to let it burn and evacuate people out because of the limited resources immediately on that scene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a whole, first responders surveyed for this study rated the area's preparedness for an oil transportation incident as below moderate. That's 2.6 on a scale of 1 to 5. None of the responders rated their area's preparedness as excellent. Analysis of data from the first responder survey provides support for a common-sense emergency management perspective. Organizations that are familiar with hazards and aware of resources, that engage in planning, training, and exercises, and that have resources available to respond will, in fact, consider themselves to be better prepared for an incident. The majority of first responders surveyed said that they did not know what additional equipment or resources are necessary to respond to an oil transportation incident. The relatively few that did provide information regarding additional resources generally said that they needed firefighting foam and related equipment. Experts from a variety of perspectives agreed that in some circumstances, the appropriate response to a significant oil fire is to let the fire burn out or down considerably before attacking the fire. The correct public safety response in that situation is to clear the area, take defensive actions to prevent life, property, and environmental damage, consider whether evacuation is warranted. For this reason, interviewees often warned against focusing on procuring equipment as a means of increasing preparedness. Additionally, some experts discussed the lessons communities have learned through other large-scale efforts at increasing preparedness through the purchase of equipment. That equipment may not be used frequently, and local governments must maintain the equipment and continuously train staff on its use. Some surveyed first responders offered the suggestion that regional or multi-county agreements regarding equipment and personnel in some cases would help increase preparedness in the majority of state, local government, and responder associations advised that identifying and sharing resources is indeed the best approach. Coordination and collaboration are significant areas for capacity development. Survey questions regarding familiarity to mutual aid agreements revealed a need for improved connections between first responders, private companies, and state agencies. A few interviewees indicated that more collaboration and cooperation are key to preparedness. Adding resources without coordination would not be helpful. The 2014 legislation provided direction and funding to state agencies to enhance preparedness. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has reviewed railroad company response plans and results of desk drills and is communicating with railroad companies. Homeland Security Emergency Management is coordinating and conducting awareness level training across the state for local first responders. The established railroad and pipeline safety account will allow expansion of preparedness efforts. A new emergency response team has been formed in Moorhead, and the MPCA and HSEM are engaged in preparedness activities. Funds available in the railroad and pipeline safety account would, while the account is still funded, support the preparedness effort larger than the state's regional plan review program, but smaller than the state's comprehensive nuclear preparedness program. Most interviewees recommended increasing training as a priority for resources, including making it easier for local responders to attend training and participate in exercises, offsetting the costs of running simulations and drills, expanding the limited number of available trainers to state agencies, and ensuring that the training program can be sustained over time. A few interviewees recommended caution and prudence in expanding funding, urging changes underway currently, particularly with regard to the training, be given time to work. MAD found that it was not feasible to develop specific assessments of costs for training and equipment for local first responders to be prepared for an oil transportation incident. Local first responders and emergency managers are in the best position to assess their own capacity, but they do not have sufficient information to identify what additional resources are available and needed to respond to an oil transportation incident. Counties and regions in the state are currently engaged in capacity assessment for the regional emergency management programs. When planners and first responders are more fully aware of the risks of oil transportation incidents and resources available, the capability assessment information will provide a basis for a more comprehensive assessment of the costs and needs. In the interim, a means of using the funds for the railroad and pipeline safety account is necessary. A regional approach to funding requests would encourage cross-jurisdiction, and cross-sector collaboration, and an emphasis on training would address many of the issues raised by the participants of this study. Subject matter experts and research literature consulted for the study indicate that there are great difficulties associated with evaluating preparedness for an oil transportation incident or other emergency. Plan review, exercises, and drills are primary ways to check an organization or area's preparedness, but these activities alone would not allow the state to know if recent changes and enhancements of preparedness were in fact having an impact. A results-based accountability approach can provide measures to evaluate the program by generating responses to three basic questions. How much did we do? How well did we do it? And is anybody better off for it? Using this approach, MAD has developed a preliminary performance measures for evaluating preparedness, but they emphasize that they should be vetted by subject matter experts and stakeholders before they're adopted. Several concerns were identified by participants in this study that are beyond the scope of this report but warrant additional attention or research, such as transportation infrastructure and the health system preparedness. Many participants discussed the importance of preventing or mitigating an oil transportation incident by improving tank cars and tracks, routing pipelines and railroads away from population centers and environmentally sensitive areas. Participants familiar with the health system emphasized the need for additional planning for incidents involving casualties and described potential problems associated with a limited number of dedicated burn beds in Minnesota. Out of the report came six recommendations. Number one, increase awareness about oil transportation incidents and then develop additional capacity. DPS is engaged in a comprehensive approach to expand awareness about oil transportation incidents that include conducting the awareness level training already underway for fire departments and other responders, developing an online resource for the public and first responders such as awareness materials and training videos, and developing guidance for first responders and local governments on responding to an oil incident, including assessment and evacuation protocols. The initial focus on building awareness more consistently across the state should be augmented by plans for large-scale drills and hands-on training for those jurisdictions that are prepared for those activities. Ultimately, DPS recommends expanding the state's training program to support more hands-on training and exercises related to emergency preparedness in general. Recommendation number two is connect funding for training and equipment to the regional coordination process. DPS recommends the resources from the Railroad Pipeline Safety Account be used first to support the training program underway at the state level. Local emergency managers are in the best position to assess their area's capabilities and needs, but many need additional information about risks and available resources related to oil transportation incidents. Additionally, DPS agrees with the findings in this study related to the need for increased coordination and collaboration. DPS has developed a process for organizations to apply for training or equipment funding available in the Railroad and Pipeline Safety Account. Requirements for funding should encourage formation of expansion of multi-county or regional cooperative groups to identify and share resources. Whenever possible, existing organizations, joint power authorities, or public-private partnerships should be utilized. To support the formation of these collaborative groups, agencies participating in the State Agency Responses Committee, particularly the Department of Public Safety and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, should develop guidelines, model charters, and other templates. These state agents should also develop a recommended evaluation format for these groups to use. Because the information from these groups will be valuable in the state's planning and preparedness efforts, DPS intends to investigate the possibility of reimbursing members of these groups under state statutes regarding advisory boards. DPS intends to administer funds in a similar way as HSEM now runs its grant programs with established regional advisory committees as a funnel for those applications. Based on the information in this study, DPS recommends that funding priorities be set in this order: training, including reimbursement for associated staffing costs, planning and coordination, and equipment that will most likely be used by first responders during an oil transportation incident, such as air monitoring equipment. Applications for funding for large-scale response equipment should include a rigorous assessment of local and regional resources and risks. The third recommendation is to delay significant changes to the Railroad and Pipeline Safety Account and related allocations. DPS recommends that the funding allocation assessment be maintained as is until the next report required under the 2014 legislation. At that time, there will be more information regarding the state's preparedness efforts and the impact of the changes underway. Future funding determinations should ensure that the preparedness efforts are sustainable. For example, funding for the new emergency response team in Moorhead will lapse at the end of fiscal year 2017. DPS further intends to prepare and publicize a plan for the use of the funding allocated under Minnesota Statute 299A.55, using information from this report, an initial assessment of training efforts underway, as well as input from the Fire Service Advisory Committee and the Technical Advisory Committee. Recommendation number four is to develop a state-level program evaluation approach to assess hazardous material preparedness activities. In order to effectively evaluate the state's actions under the 2014 legislation, DPS recommends that the state develop a program evaluation process and framework for hazardous materials incident preparedness. Agencies participating in the State Agency's Response Committee, particularly DPS and MPCA, should jointly develop a list of priority results for preparedness activities and establish timelines and measures to show progress towards those results. DPS recommends that information on these results be incorporated in the annual report to the legislature on hazardous materials and oil discharge readiness. DPS further recommends that these state agencies also agree to collect and share data as needed under the evaluation process, and that the agencies jointly request railroad companies provide a report on their coordination efforts required under Minnesota Statute 115E.042. DPS further recommends that resources from the railroad and pipeline safety account be used to partially offset any cost of evaluation, with the remaining cost shared equally among the responder agencies. Recommendation number 5 is to enhance existing databases or develop a new database to provide more comprehensive information about response resources across the state. DPS intends to identify whether its existing resource database system can be modified to include additional information regarding resources from state agencies, private sector organizations, and local governments, including but not limited to resources needed to respond to an oil transportation incident. The existing database is accessible to Minnesota duty officer and to local government first responders. DPS intends to gather information from railroad and pipeline companies regarding resources and their contractors' resources to populate the database. We will develop a set of categories for response equipment and resources to ensure consistency. As an interim step while the database is being developed, DPS intends to direct HSEM to compile the information regarding private sector resources and provide it to local governments on its secure network to aid local first responders in their planning efforts. If it's not feasible to utilize existing systems, DPS will work with Minnesota Geospatial Information Office, other agency partners, and the private sector advisors to develop mapping and database capabilities to determine what funding may be needed to support database development and maintenance. And recommendation number 6 is to establish standards for pipeline preparedness and response. For local and state governments to be able to determine what resources may be needed to develop response capacity to an oil transportation incident, it will be necessary to determine if rail and pipeline companies are adequately prepared to respond. The most concrete ways to evaluate preparedness are to examine an organization's written plan against established criteria and to test the organization's preparedness through existing drills, through exercises and drills. The new requirements for rail companies will allow the state to examine rail preparedness efforts, but pipeline companies do not have a similarly well-defined responsibility. Pipelines also transport significant quantities of potentially dangerous material in Minnesota, so additional attention to pipeline preparedness is warranted. DPS recommends that the state adopt response standards, including timelines, for pipeline companies that are similar in scope and content to the response standards applicable to railroads. DPS has not developed a position regarding the appropriate response times for pipelines, but will participate in the legislative process as requested. With that, Mr. Chair, are the 6 recommendations. We will stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Donansky. Before we get into questions, it seems a lot of these findings and recommendations are based on the information that you gathered from interviews with, as it listed here, public safety officials and then state and local elected officials in areas potentially affected by oil transportation. Could you maybe expand on that a little bit and give us an idea of who these people are, who we talk to, maybe the numbers, so we understand who this is?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if a representative from MAD is here. They actually conducted the study, so I don't have the specific numbers. But I do know that they approached the associations, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, the Fire Chiefs Association, the Emergency Management Association. We did reach out to the railroad companies, the pipeline companies, and there were select local and state elected officials that were interviewed. But I do not know what the exact number is, sir.
Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Donansky, the state has been through a rather rigorous emergency preparedness program in the past. I think, wasn't it following 9/11 or Katrina? I don't recall. But to what extent, I mean, is there existing statute that pretty much does this? I mean, does this mimic what we've already done in many ways for other kinds of disasters? And how different would the pipeline disaster be than some of the disasters that have already been kind of conceived of?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're exactly correct. Minnesota takes an all-hazards approach to how we respond to incidents. And I think what the report pointed out, that we have a very strong foundation of that in the state and that we would respond to an oil incident similar to how we would respond to something else. What I do think the report pointed out, though, was that this is different. This is a different type of product. And so there needs to be more education and more understanding about what is being transported from the standpoint of hazardous materials so we can train and exercise those individuals that are part of that all-hazard approach for the correct way to respond.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Donaski, I mean, given what's in place in terms of a structure, framework, people, I mean, what percent of what we need is available already, would you say?
To Donaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think a good portion of it is ready, and I think what the report also pointed out was, as the old saying goes, we don't know what we don't know. And I think as we move forward and we start to explore this and start to talk with the pipeline companies and the rail companies about what resources they have, what resources we have among the agencies that are out there already now, and determine what kind of training and exercise needs to be done, we will come back, I think, to the legislature and have that conversation.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Donaski, and the department for doing this report. I just had a couple of comments and a question. The first is I really applaud your recommendation number 6. Members may not be know that towards the end of session last year we hammered out a compromise that included pipelines in the legislation, but you know, this piece that the railroad companies agreed to was not agreed to by the pipeline companies. For example, in the event of a major spill, which is defined in state statute, what we wanted to see happen and what you're recommending happen was a specific timeline for response. So if there, let's say there's a catastrophic pipeline leak and a first responder confirms that leak, all we were asking is that a representative from the pipeline company would call and start advising by phone the first responder. I don't know why, within an hour, I don't know why that's such a difficult thing, and that someone be on the scene within 3 hours. Again, this, you know, these first few minutes of a problem like this are absolutely crucial. Time is of the essence. And when you said, Mr. Donaski, that we're leaving this mostly up to the companies to do, and the fact that they're not agreeing to even simply make a phone call within an hour to have someone on the scene within 3 hours is very, very concerning. And if that's not the exact right timeline, then let's come to the table and talk about it. These companies actually left the table, and you know, their approach was let's not even include pipelines at all in the legislation. So I think your number 6 is really important. I hope we can get that done this session. Again, the railroad companies did agree to it, and I think that we should have everyone transporting oil also agree to this recommendation number 6. But the question I have, and maybe it's a follow-up to Representative Runbeck's, you had, there's a concerning finding, several concerning findings, but the one that really jumped out at me is this, you know, we're below moderate. I guess that would be, if we're giving a letter grade, maybe below average, a D, although 2.6 out of 5 is probably an F, even grading on the curve. So depending on if you're an easy or a hard grader, we either have a D or an F in terms of first responders rating their air, I think it's rating their area's preparedness, you know, adequately. And so if the first responders themselves are not prepared or feel that they're not prepared, I find that very, very concerning. And we have this fund, and I'll say to Representative Deskowski that the fund that they were talking about is not the people's money. This is money that the pipeline and rail companies have contributed. And so do you view this fund as a way to deal with this very, very wide gap in the knowledge between you know, what first responders are currently saying in terms of their ability to respond and what you would envision as something adequate? You say in the report we don't need additional resources, but how do you feel that we're going to really get to, instead of a D or an F, an A or at least a B?
Mr. Donaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was a large question. Let me see if I can take little bits and pieces of it. And going back, The 2.6, I think that as the researcher went out and discussed this across the state of Minnesota, as I mentioned, we have a very robust all-hazards approach to how we do our business with first responders. And I think they're confident in the way they're doing their business out there. I think where the shortcoming is that some areas of the state aren't as familiar with oil transportation as others. We had heard about Coon Rapids, Roseville. Those areas and those departments, those responders that deal with it on an ongoing basis are far more versed, far more educated in what's associated with that. And so we have this disparity across the state where we have some agencies that are very, very good, very, very prepared, have a lot of education associated with it, and then we have other areas of the state where this is a relatively new phenomenon to them. So I think what we're trying to do, Representative, on the first piece of this, to your point about utilizing these funds, is provide this awareness training over the course of the first year, which we were mandated to do by the legislation, to get everybody up to that level of awareness about what we're talking about, and then continue to use the funds as we develop our program to enhance that training all across the state, or at least across the areas where we have the potential for these incidents happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. I think to that point, you look at page 29 and 30 of the report and our handout, you can see that between pipelines and oil train routes, almost all of the state is within a county or two of one of these. I mean, there's certainly some exceptions, but you know, a good portion of the state is within, you know, very close proximity to one of these routes, and again, the majority coming from oil-producing areas to the west and north of us. You know, we have the Castleton explosion, 47 fatalities. We even had an ethanol train derail last week in Iowa, big fire. Fortunately, there weren't people around there, but three of the cars wound up in the Mississippi River, and they were leaking, which, again, speaks to this timely response. But in the report, you also referenced the fact that you had talked directly to pipeline and railroad companies about their emergency response plans, and I think you mentioned some cooperated and others didn't in terms of providing that information. Could you share with us who didn't respond to you and why?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as I know, all the agencies responded. I think that there was probably, I think that what the report is alluding to is that some agencies gave over a lot of information, some agencies probably didn't give over as much information, so there were some shortcomings in what they turned over. But as far as my knowledge, and I'll look at my colleagues here, I believe all the pipeline companies responded and all the railroad companies responded as well.
Okay, but Mr. Chair, in terms of sharing their emergency response plans as well as worst case scenario plans, which I know that they all have, those were all received by the department.
The emergency response plans are actually routed to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and looking at the chief engineer, we're still waiting on two pipelines.
Okay. Well, I'll just say in conclusion, Mr. Chair, I think that this is a good start, but I'm very concerned about making sure that these companies are a little more forthcoming about sharing their plans. Some of it is required by law. I think by June of 2015, these all have to be submitted. But beyond that, I think it'd be incumbent for them to share their plans in general with the public, not just the state agencies.
Thank you. Mr. Donasky, along with that line of questioning, I guess, your recommendation, or the recommendation three, says to delay significant changes to the railroad and pipeline safety account related allocations. Is that part of the problem? As you stated, we don't know what we don't know. So do we need time for that information and for processing of that information before we make any major changes here?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That is the recommendation of the report, that as we move forward and we conduct training, we do more analysis, we do more exercises, that as we come back to this committee and other committees, we'll have more information, we'll make a better decision about what type of additional resources are needed beyond the scope of what this current funding is.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious about what I learned a few weeks ago when the railroads were here. And then when you're talking today, the relationship between the railroads and the pipeline companies and the communities and the first responders, which are public sector groups. Can you help frame for me a better understanding of whose responsibility is what in terms of the safety? If there's an accident in Motley or Staples, Minnesota, is it the railroad who's is responsible? And this would, in this case, would be a railroad example. Can you outline those responsibilities for me?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative. Yeah. Initially, obviously, you're going to have your fire department or local responders initially there, but we will rely on the railroad to partner with us to come to a conclusion on whatever that event is. So you're going to have a tiered response where you're going to have your public fire department, law enforcement, county sheriff respond, and then the assets from the responsible party, whether that be pipeline or rail, would then augment that and potentially take over the technical response of that as we continue to look at the public safety side, as they deal with environment or finally putting the fire out with assistance from the public, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then to follow up on specifically something, the use of foam, it was mentioned here today. As I understand it, that's the primary tool to fight a fire that would be, whether it be with a natural gas pipeline or an oil pipe, oil with the railroads, or can you help me understand that?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in any flammable liquid, foam is would be the choice. The challenge can be water supply in some of these rural supply areas. So providing large amounts of foam, while it can do good, you need to have all the other resources that would need to be there for that foam. So looking at one item of foam is one piece of the bigger response. Talking with both pipeline and rail, they do have quantities of foam within the state that they can draw upon to bring to a scene. But foam has to be applied strategically. You just can't start spraying water and foam. I give you an analogy like a grease fire on a stove. We talk and talk and talk about not putting water on that because you can spread that. Some of those same challenges, if you look at from a pan of grease to a 30,000-gallon oil tanker, if you just go in and start spraying foam randomly, that can potentially make this worse. So that's why in the recommendations you have this potentially let it burn down a little bit to strategically apply the foam where we can bring in railroad workers who are specifically trained to do that, and if we can continue to protect exposures from the using the local fire department and then allow the experts to come in and almost surgically put that foam on there, it'll go much faster. That's exactly what they did in Castleton, North Dakota. They let it burn to a point. Railroad came in and then used their assets to put that out, if that helps.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that response. Then we learned that the foam is stored in Minneapolis and Fargo. And I assume that foam, that seemed far away from Staples to me. And the response was that that should give us enough time. Would you agree that there's enough foam stored in the state to respond to along the main line?
That is one of the parts that we're looking at in one of the recommendations in the report, is to try to gather all those, where every one of those pieces of assets are, both from the rail and pipeline company and the locals, so that we can try to get a better map as to what actually is out there and then what is a reasonable response time. So that is part of what we're trying to work on right now because of the study.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Danaski and others, have you, in developing your study, had you looked at, is it scalable depending on the volume of oil coming through the state? Certainly the Bakken and the work that they've done out there has been a boon to not only our economy here, but nationwide as of recent. And so we have seen over the last couple of years a large amount of volume coming through that is really in contrast to what we've experienced, you know, prior to that. Now we're actually seeing, I suspect, is probably dropping down as price goes down, and who knows where that could go. But even the idea of getting more of this oil into pipelines, if we can get the Sandpiper pipeline approved here finally, would take pressure off of railroads. I'm just curious. I mean, certainly the public discourse has gone past some level of threshold because of this large volume we've had over the last couple of years. At what point does it, if it drops back down again because of some of those factors, I mean, do you have the same response when the volume of trains is up here as you do down here?
Dinesky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand your question correctly on the scalable piece of it, one of the recommendations, and clearly DPS supports it and has for some time, is that we're not building the capacity for this just based upon the oil transportation, but rather adding oil as one of the all-hazards approach that we already have out there. So it really shouldn't matter whether or not there's a lot of oil or the oil diminishes. We're going to continue to train. We're going to continue to do the things that build on this all-hazards approach that we have. I'm trying to figure a correct answer. Would we tailor it back if there was less oil? I don't anticipate that. We're just adding oil as just another piece to the puzzle that we have for response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dinesky.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, whoever would like to answer this. In previous committees, we've heard that part of the problem is that maybe the railroad staff didn't know what was in the cars, and while I appreciate all the preparedness, with this new study and things that we can do going forward, do you think there is now enough knowledge between the railroad staff, for instance, and the local communities to know when these dangerous or hazardous materials are going through their communities so that they will be better prepared in a timely fashion to address this rather than waiting for a crash or something to happen?
Mr.
Representative, if I understand your question correctly, would you be asking much like a rail schedule that they know at 8 o'clock in the morning that I have not seen that. Rail traffic, if we can plan for whatever is there on the rail, I think there's enough information through various sources that can get to the local jurisdiction. I couldn't answer if there would be, if I would know, even in my own community, half a mile from my house, the train goes by 20 sometimes a day. Do I have the information exactly what is on that rail at 8 o'clock, midnight, or whatever? No, I don't. So I don't know if that information, I think having been a fire chief of a small town, I do believe they provide, or there's ways to provide enough information for that local jurisdiction to develop a response plan for that. Like any common carrier, those things change on the rail all the time. So I don't know how accurate or timely that could be to do that, but that would be up to the rail to answer that question further about that information.
Okay, I'll ask it a different time. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The slide on page 9 at the top, it's titled Other Issues. Several concerns were identified by participants in this study that are beyond the scope of this report. I was a little surprised that they weren't somehow within the scope of the report and what happens to them, because each of them seem to relate to some of the things we're talking about. And I'll just pull out one: allowing rail companies to have their own law enforcement personnel. We've talked about this before, and what I heard you say is we have to determine what other resources are available, and one of them, throughout here there is this concern about sufficient trained personnel, how you provide the training. But in this case, my understanding is that there are already railroad police that presumably they're already trained. It's just that we're an outlier. We in Minnesota don't certify them as peace officers as perhaps some other states. And so is there a ready source of trained personnel that for some reason we're not using? So how are those beyond the scope of the report, and what happens to them? Do they get dealt with by somebody else?
Mr. Dinesky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned early on, the study scope was rather narrowly focused on public safety preparedness and response. And so some of the pieces that you're talking about were the health side of things and the infrastructure side. We didn't ask people what they thought specifically about the rail cars. That got included in here because in the conversations, people did want to share those concerns. And so out of respect for those comments, I think that the individuals who put the report together threw those in just to let people know that there were other conversations people were thinking about those things. Specifically regarding your comments about the resources that are available, I think that that's part of the process of going through and determining where the resources are, what resources can be brought to bear. Going back to the previous conversation that that Mr. Reed had talking about foam, part of the report is for us, the Department of Public Safety, to work with the railroads and the pipelines to determine what resources they have, where they have them, how can they be accessed, and then to determine what the response time is and if we are having a gap someplace, we need to fill that in. So the short answer, I guess, to your question is, in particular to the railroad police, I suspect that we'll have that conversation to find out whether or not that is a resource that could add to the mix.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to return to the question that Representative Mason asked, and I think Mr. Reed's response, I mean, there's a reason that Mr. Reed doesn't know exactly what's on those trains and et cetera, because back in the 90s, there was federal legislation called Community Safety and Right to Know, and which was a way for communities to know, you know, what the toxic materials that were in their community, you know, specifically what those were. But the railroad companies got an exemption from that in the 90s. I think, you know, something was going on in Washington, D.C., I suppose, at that time when that bill was debated in Congress. But I think that's a huge gap as well. I don't think that transportation should be exempted from that very important law. So I think there's a reason why that you and Representative Mason both don't know the exact, you know, compounds and, you know, what's going through there, and I think it would be very, very helpful for first responders to know that. And it was interesting, Mr. Chair, we had a series of listening sessions with first responders around the state that the governor convened, I think 7 of them, and a number of first responders had identified this as a problem, this lack of information because of the exemption and community right to know. So I hope that's something that can be addressed at the federal level, but I think we should also have some conversations about that here at the state level.
Representative Ubel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, good report and interesting key findings and things. My question, Mr. Donosky, is do we have an action plan? Do we have a timeline for the implementation of some of these very important findings? It's critical that we move forward. So what's the action plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent point. The report was just released January 1st, and so we just got the report finished. We are still going over it and looking at it. I will tell you that, and I will again defer to Mr. Reed, we have begun the familiarization training already out there, and I'll defer again. How many trainings have we completed, Mr. Reed?
Mr. Chair, as of tomorrow, it will be 50 that we have completed, and we have 55 more scheduled between now and the end of June.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, the familiarization training, which was mandated, is a combination of those industries, pipeline and rail, working with the Department of Public Safety and Pollution Control. And we've developed a four-hour program that we've taken out that's post-certified. And as Mr. Reed pointed out, we're making very good progress. We think that we will have attempted to get to all the fire departments mandated by statute that are on those lines or adjacent to those lines by the end of this fiscal year. As we move forward from that, once we get everybody up to that familiarization stage, now we're going to set, and Mr. Reed and his staff are working on the next level of training that goes along. And I believe, sir, you mentioned you were in Coon Rapids. Clearly, the Coon Rapids Fire Department already has familiarization training with this, and so repeating that for them wouldn't be worth anything. We're already looking at the next levels. Once we get everybody to that first level, what's the next level? How do we start to exercise? How do we start to incorporate that all hazards approach into planning for emergencies, so it's not just the fire department, but it incorporates the fire department, the police departments, the sheriff's office, the emergency manager, and elected officials in these large-scale exercises. So I don't have a specific timeline that says this is the date that we're going to do it by, but we do have a roadmap of where we're going to go.
Thank you.
Mr. Nasky, I know the railroads also supply training for first responders. In fact, when we were going through when the governor was down in Red Wing, our first responders were out west in training for that. How does that training coincide with the training you're talking about?
Might have Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, the training we developed was in conjunction with both pipeline and the railroad. So in our four-hour training, the railroad representatives come in and do their hour. Then we, as HSEM, do an hour on the emergency management side of it, the consequence management side of it. Then we have the pollution control agency do the half an hour of theirs, and then the pipeline does a half an hour. So we try to incorporate all the pieces from the experts in their field to get to that awareness level for the local responders.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I for the opportunity to raise a question that came up in last year's hearings, or it was this fall, in a previous hearing. And that's the question of training time for our local volunteer firefighters. You know, in our small towns, our firefighters are playing amazing roles, and these are leaders in the communities. They're earning a living to raise their families, et cetera, et cetera. And then we learn that we're adding to the training and adding to the training. And I would assume, well, my question is, did that challenge come before this study? And if so, any thoughts you have on how to, you know, reconcile that challenge? Need for training, but also the need for these firefighters to live their lives and maintain their standard of living and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, and yes. You know, let my colleague, the former fire chief, talk about the level of training that's required out there. That was brought up, and I think that's why this legislation specifically outlines that the fund can be used to reimburse those organizations that send firefighters or first responders to this training. And so there is the ability for an organization, say a city or a county or some, when they send their firefighters, that they can be reimbursed for their time.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Reed.
Having been in the world of a volunteer firefighter for 18 years here in Minnesota, I totally understand the time that it takes. And that's why we did this four-hour block, because on a traditional fire department training schedule, that's about 3.5 to 4 hours is about the time you get in their routine. And so we met with the training officers and said, how would this best fit? What would work for you? Also, understanding that we're not going to get every single of the 20,000 or plus firefighters in Minnesota, but if we can get a good portion or then start to do regional trainings where we get the first group out there that's right on the track, then we move to the mutual aid partners, and then we move to the rest of the state, we can bits and pieces. So maybe a fire department that has 20 people can send 5 to this one and 5 to this one so that we can eventually get to all. We know that there's no way that we're going to get an entire fire department to sit down outside of their jurisdiction for 4 hours. So we're bringing this to them in their fire station to better get that bang for the buck so that they don't have to leave their jurisdiction to do this training. Now, further on training, we may offer that, but for right now it's at their station or a neighboring station in their jurisdiction to best accommodate them.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you for being here, committee, today. We appreciate your time with that. And with that, members, our next meeting is at originally scheduled time at 12:45 in the basement. We'll be going over the governor's recommendations or budget for MnDOT. I should also let Representative Atkins know the bill from the governor, we do not have the language for that yet, but I'm sure that's coming. That's just part of the process, so we'll wait for that as well. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.